How do we make it rain? Seed the clouds. It could spell relief in times of drought, but there are lots of critics.
They think we have some sort of godlike powers where we can just move clouds around at will, whatever fickle mood we're in that day.
I'm Carol Holsapel. This week on the Allegheny Front, the stormy history and unclear future of cloud seeding. Plus, artists in Pittsburgh turn old metal and glass into something that looks a little bit more organic. And we pay homage to the people that suck it up and clean out our dirtiest garbage.
Anything that you would think would be in a sewer that shouldn't be in a sewer does come into this sewer.
Those and more environmental stories are coming up on the Allegheny Front. Stay with us. The company that owns the pipeline that exploded in Westmoreland County this April said that 4 years ago it saw the corrosion that ultimately led the pipe to fail. But the company didn't think it needed to replace the pipe at the time. The Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier explains.
When Spectra Energy saw the corrosion during a 2012 inspection of its Texas Eastern pipeline, its models predicted the pipe wasn't at risk. But the pipe corroded 5 times faster than the models suggested, leading to the April 29th blast. Spectra's Andy Drake told a public forum in Salem Township, no one could have predicted the pipe would degrade in such a short time frame.
The models that industry uses based on research and data and science didn't accurately predict how fast this thing could grow.
Drake said possible causes are a tape that was used on the line, high temperature gas from a nearby compressor station, or some other local condition. But this didn't ease the pain for some in the audience, like Carol Webb, aunt of a 27-year-old man badly burned in the blast.
If you check those pipelines and they come off at the slightest, if they're off even 1 point or whatever you're saying, and it's in a community, these pipelines are running through people's backyards, shouldn't they be replaced?
That prompted this response from Drake.
There are no words that I can possibly even give you that can explain how sorry we are of what's happened here.
Drake said the explosion will likely lead to an industry-wide reassessment of what to do when corrosion is detected.
The models we were using were based on tons and tons of research and data, and they thought those models were conservative. Now we've got a new piece of information that's telling us we have to learn.
The company said it's tested 400 other potential problem sites in a more than 200-mile stretch of the pipeline since the explosion. None had the same corrosion as was found in the area where the pipe failed. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Reed Frazier.
This month, Pittsburgh is hosting its first Renew Festival, which celebrates art and performance that's all about reusing materials and environmental sustainability. I headed downtown to take a look at one of the sculptures commissioned for the festival. It's fashioned from something most of us see every day.
The lights are the insulators.
Street lights. Duquesne Light donated about 30 of them and some other decommissioned fixtures for sculptors like Tim Collin to reimagine.
There's a constant flow of really terrific objects and shapes and materials that go through their process.
Collin is a member of the Industrial Arts Cooperative. He says he and the other artists working on this piece got to pick through Duquesne Light's Manchester facility in the north side, what he calls their boneyard. It was basically like a shopping spree for materials before they were recycled. Collin says that's an upside of upcycling a utility company's trash. There are downsides, but they can also be fun.
It's a little dance with the materials, and sometimes they win, and sometimes you cannot resolve them to the way that you want them to fit. But ultimately, there's a new harmony.
The base of the sculpture is built of I-beams from a Duquesne Light power station at the Cary Furnaces, a former blast furnace for the steel industry just outside of Pittsburgh. It's tiered, reminiscent of ancient pyramids found in Latin America. Eddie Opat is one of the designers of the piece, and says it's inspired by pre-Columbian architecture.
One of the main things we were trying to do is use this consumer infrastructure refuse to build something that nods to a culture that was sustainable in itself.
Last weekend, Opat and others put the finishing touches on the sculpture that's 18 feet tall and surrounded by office buildings in downtown Pittsburgh's Gateway Center Plaza.
Hayden, can you bring your side up, like, a little bit? Yeah, yeah.
High school student Hayden Alexander has been an apprentice with the other artists in their mobile sculpture workshop, learning to weld and work with metal.
I'm gonna go ahead and do this one.
From a ladder, he's securing the cobra heads, the light fixtures, into their permanent arrangement.
The general feel of Gateway Center is sort of all the buildings are very sterile. And this piece itself follows some of the geometry that we see in Gateway Center, but it's more natural and more flowing.
It's interesting that you use the word natural about things like glass and metal and wires.
Yeah, well, I mean, we're making something that's certainly more than the sum of its parts. We're using industry and urban elements to create something that has natural beauty.
It looks a bit like a silver flower sprouting in the courtyard of these high-rises. Eddie Opak clears off the slag, a protective coating left after the weld, with a piece of scrap metal and a brush. Eventually, the sculpture will glow. The instruments have been rewired with LEDs. Opat says the piece is called Almanera, Spanish for beacon.
It's a beacon for sustainability and moving forward, and hopefully kind of inspire people to take things out of their conventional form and explore other options after their intended life.
You can see Almanera at Gateway Center until October 9th, and in photos at our website. There's more about the Renew Festival there, too. That's AlleghenyFront.org. This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapple. What's it like to go below the surface and into an active sewer system? For some men and women whose job it is to clear out the muck, every day is a new adventure.
And all of a sudden, it broke free and a big condom slapped me right in the face.
Whoa. These workers help keep the rivers clean for us. A little respect, people. Coming up later on the Allegheny Front. Stay tuned. The Chesapeake Bay has a pollution problem, and multiple state and federal agencies and nonprofits are working together to clean it up. The Susquehanna River watershed, which covers half of Pennsylvania, feeds the Chesapeake. Jeffrey Allenby with the Chesapeake Conservancy says with a new grant from the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation, high-resolution technology they've developed will bring land conservation efforts in Clinton and Center counties into the 21st century. Over the last few decades, conservation groups have used what he calls moderate-resolution data to identify where they should put projects on the ground. But there were gaps in the data. I spoke with Allenby by phone and asked how this new technology is different.
Moderate resolution data is typically collected by satellite, and each pixel in the image represents a 30-meter by 30-meter square on the ground, or about a quarter acre. The data that we are generating is 1-meter resolution, so it has about 900 times the amount of data, and allows you to see a 1-meter by 1-meter square in the ground. It allows us to identify small-scale features like individual trees or small buffers that have a really large ecological benefit, where the moderate resolution just generalizes everything within that quarter acre as one thing, whether it's a trees or a crop or wetlands or water.
So are you still using satellites to collect the data, or how do you collect the data?
Our imagery that we're using is actually collected by airplanes. Aerial imagery, and it's flown by the USDA's Farm Service Agency every 2 years, and originally intended for agricultural monitoring, but because it's collected by a federal agency, that imagery is available to us, and what we do is we reprocess that into the land cover data. So taking a raw image, you know, if you look at it, you know what a tree is or what a road is, and teaching the computer to make those same judgments.
What kinds of conservation or restoration decisions can be influenced? How do you use it?
One of the biggest things that we're looking at in particular in Pennsylvania as part of this grant is riparian forest buffers. These are trees that run along streams and rivers and really act as kind of a last line of defense for sediment and nutrients from entering waterways. What we can do is identify where you don't have trees in place, and by looking at elevation data, figure out how water is moving across the landscape to be able to say, where do these gaps exist? You know, where do we have opportunities to plant trees? And where do you have the most amount of upland draining through those gaps, where if you put in more trees or if you do a tree planting in those gaps, you can really achieve a much larger amount of reductions based on that upland in that area.
How does this new pilot project in the Susquehanna, which is funded by the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation, how does that fit into the Conservancy's other work?
This is the culmination, actually, of a couple of years of work of building relationships with partners who are doing on-the-ground restoration throughout the Susquehanna River watershed. We've seen a large call from our partners for this kind of data to help inform where they are working on the ground. So over the next 3 years, we're going to be implementing a number of restoration projects. Our goal is to have 5 to 8 on the ground in Center and Clinton counties, and then also create a replicable model that can be translated throughout the state of Pennsylvania and throughout the Susquehanna watershed.
I think when people hear the word Chesapeake, they think Maryland.
Mm-hmm.
And so just say a little bit more about how Pennsylvania fits into the Chesapeake Bay watershed.
So the Susquehanna watershed drains about 27,000 square miles in a little bit of Maryland, predominantly in Pennsylvania, and a little bit in New York. And that represents a little under half of the Chesapeake Bay watershed. So Pennsylvania is responsible for a large portion of the fresh water entering the Chesapeake Bay. And while the bay proper, the shoreline, is in Maryland and Virginia, a lot of the sediment and nutrient pollution and a lot of the fresh water entering the bay is actually coming down the Susquehanna River. So actions that happen 400 miles away in Cooperstown, New York, or in Harrisburg, or along the Susquehanna, they have a direct impact on water quality entering the Chesapeake Bay. But it's also about impacting water quality at the streams and rivers at home. You know, we want people to be able to go fishing and kayaking all throughout the Susquehanna River, and it just happens to also impact water quality downriver.
And when you say sediment and nutrients, are we talking about agricultural runoff?
It's agricultural runoff is definitely a big source of nitrogen and phosphorus pollution as well as sediment or dirt, but that also comes from suburban and urban stormwater. It comes from wastewater treatment plants. So it's not any one source.
So is this kind of technology the future of conservation? Is it widely used now, or what? You know, where is it headed?
It definitely is the future. I wouldn't say that it's widely used yet. More than anything, it improves the efficiency of projects. So staff are spending less time on the computer making maps or doing analysis, and they're spending more time in the field, you know, actually doing conservation. We're starting to see a lot of interest from partners across the country and honestly around the world, looking at the models that we've been able to develop here, and they're facing the same challenges in terms of water quality, in terms of restoration and conservation work. My daily job is to figure out new ways to do things that have been done a certain way for the last 30 or 40 years, and to say, how do we challenge the status quo, and how do we do more with what we have and really help the Chesapeake Bay restoration movement make measurable strides forward, especially in some areas where goals haven't necessarily been met yet. You know, Pennsylvania has been doing a lot of great work, but right now they're on track to be behind for the 2017 midpoint assessment and the 2025 goal of having swimmable, fishable rivers. You know, we feel like we can really play a role, and we are seeing that we're really playing a role in advancing everyone's work and making a big difference on what's going on the ground.
Jeffrey Allenby is Director of Conservation Technology at the Chesapeake Conservancy. And we should say that they're funded in part by the Richard King Mellon Foundation and the Foundation for Pennsylvania Watersheds, which also fund the Allegheny Front. There's more at our website, alleghenyfront.org. I'm Carol Holsapple. So as we heard, when it rains, sewer overflows can dump waste right into the river. Alcosan, the Pittsburgh region's sewer authority, is trying to reduce overflows. To do that, hundreds of riverside structures, the gateways between the sewer lines and the rivers, have to constantly be checked, rinsed out, and unclogged by maintenance crews. Lou Bluen joined one crew to shine a spotlight on the men and women who do this dirty and largely invisible job.
We're going to go down here a little piece and hose out real quick. My name is Charles Simone. I'm a supervisor on regional conveyance for Alcosan. It's amazing some of the things you find in a sewer that you wouldn't think would be in there besides the normal waste products. During a heavy rain event, we will get a lot of weeds, rocks, tires, railroad ties, trees, anything that you would think would be in a sewer that shouldn't be in a sewer does come into this sewer.
Hey, Daryl, what were you just looking at?
Rat's carcass.
There was a rat carcass?
Yes. We need to get rid of that. We need a hose.
That's where we get that expression, a drowned rat. There's really one here.
So, what's the grossest thing you've ever done, Charles?
Well, when I first came out here, I was working on the crew trucks. And they said, we got to go down there and pull that rack. Well, I really didn't have an understanding of what pulling the rack was. And in certain structures, we have these racks that are like a metal grating with fingers on them. And it would collect all the rags, the tampons, the condoms, and the rats, and any debris. So I was down there pulling the rack one day, and I'm struggling pulling it off. And all of a sudden, it broke free, and a big condom slapped me right in the face. So, I mean, it is a gross, gross job. So you wash properly, and hopefully your wife or girlfriend still wants to talk to you after you tell them that joke.
I am Shonda Kelly. I work at Alcosan as a vacuum truck operator. It's like your garden hose with high pressure, and it's like a shop vac with high pressure. I tend to find that I am less afraid of the bugs and animals and the dirt than they are.
So who's drawn the short straw today to have to go in the hole?
I'm not sure yet. We try to let the crew figure it out who wants to go down and perform that duty.
So you got to go down in that hole?
Yes, I do. I'm looking forward to it.
Why do they send the biggest guy down in the smallest hole?
I don't know.
Who's going to hold my wallet?
Yeah, listen. To...
There's nothing in it.
You ain't getting it. It's going down with me. It's going down with me. Down with the ship.
Let's bring Mike in here. Feel like an unsung hero at times doing this work?
Very much so. It's a very underappreciated task. You know, people, they don't like the equipment in their way. And once we get started, a lot of times, they certainly don't like the smell. But if these lines aren't clean, if we don't keep these structures hosed out, everything's going to be backing up. Sewage backing up into their basements or businesses. So all this is underground for the most part. You know, so it's not paid attention to. People take it for granted. But it's something that needs to be done to make the waters better for everybody to use.
All right, when you're ready.
Those were the voices of Mike Altimore, Donnie Smith, Shonda Kelly, Daryl Smith, and crew supervisor Charles Simone, a.k.a. the men and women of Pittsburgh's sewers. Their story is part of our series about Pittsburgh's Three Rivers. You can hear more and see some photographs of the Alcosan crew at work at our website, AlleghenyFront.org. Now, while we have plenty of precipitation in our region, the record summer temperatures and drought out west have a lot of people wondering how to better manage water, even while it's still in the sky. We're talking about cloud seeding, trying to make it rain by introducing chemicals into clouds. It's practiced all over the world, but there's still a lot we don't know. Stephen Jackson delves into the surprising history, the controversial present, and the uncertain future of cloud seeding.
For as long as humans have been around, we've been at the mercy of the weather. And for as long as that's been the case, we've wanted a way out, a way to control the weather to suit our needs. In the distant past, we used sacrifices, rain dances. Today, we turn to science, which is where cloud seeding comes in. It's humanity's latest attempt to do what has always seemed impossible, to harness the clouds and make them rain. Let's begin in Fargo, North Dakota, at the headquarters of Weather Modification Incorporated, or WMI. It's the largest cloud seeding company in the world.
I like to say that we're the Microsoft or the Starbucks of the weather modification world because we've got like 14 full-time personnel. So
Hans Allness is the vice president of operations. We take a walk through the Bravo hangar. It's an ice cream white warehouse about the size of a football field.
So here's another kind of airplane. This is a piston twin. This one will be in California this winter, making snow.
WMI seeds clouds for water districts, public utilities, hydroelectric power companies, any organization that wants more precipitation.
Yeah, what they're trying to do is make more snow that in the spring melts and fills dams for hydroelectric power, and eventually in California, water gets used about 3 times. So it'll be hydroelectric power, it'll be irrigation, municipal water. So maybe eventually it'll get to the ocean.
WMI will send its fleet of planes to Wyoming, Idaho, Nevada, and California. Once they get there, they'll fly into frigid winter clouds, spraying a mist of chemicals, hoping to trigger snow. And when it gets warmer, they'll fly somewhere else and make rain instead. We'll get to how cloud seeding works in a little bit. First, some history. Over the years, people have tried all kinds of crazy ideas to squeeze more water out of the sky.
There's a lot of colorful people, let's put it that way.
Jim Fleming is a professor of science, technology, and society at Colby College. He says one of the first big rainmaking projects in America was proposed in the 1830s by a meteorologist named James Espy. Espy thought he could increase precipitation by sending hot air into the atmosphere, which would then cool and fall as rain. His big idea was to set fire to the Appalachian Mountains every weekend.
And by Monday morning, the air would be fresh and the rivers would be full, recharged with water, and the fields would be watered as well. And people thought he was really crazy.
But Espy was completely sane compared to General Robert Dyrenforth, who got into the rainmaking game in the 1890s. He wasn't a real general, by the way. He just called himself one. And Dyrenforth thought that explosions shook the clouds and caused rain. And so, with federal funding, he put together a huge arsenal of explosives and headed to Texas.
And proceeded to try to make it rain by shooting off fireworks, floating balloons that were filled with hydrogen and blowing them up in the sky. And it was very entertaining for the locals.
But it didn't work, like, at all. Fast forward about half a century to 1947 at the General Electric Corporation Research Lab. That year, three scientists were working on making artificial clouds: Irving Langmuir, Vincent Schaefer, and Bernard Vonnegut. And here's a fun fact. Bernard was Kurt Vonnegut's brother. Some of Kurt's sci-fi novels were inspired by Bernie's work. Anyway.
These three, Langmuir, Schaefer, and Vonnegut, are kind of known as the triumvirate of the early days of cloud seeding.
One day, the triumvirate was working in the lab, making little clouds in a freezer box. Schaefer took some dry ice, the same stuff people use to make fog in a haunted house, and scraped it into a cloud they just made, where it blossomed into millions of tiny ice particles. Snow.
And he says, aha, I think I've got something here. And so he went out with a rented airplane over the Berkshires, and they sprinkled some dry ice over a cloud, and they made a little snowstorm.
We put about 6 pounds of dry ice into this 4-mile cloud, and within a very few minutes, saw long streamers of snow falling from the base of the cloud and evaporating into the drier air below.
Here's how it works. Clouds are full of water, but they won't precipitate unless there's an impurity in the cloud, some little fleck for the water molecules to glom onto, like soot or mineral dust, or in this case, dry ice. Once that impurity enters the picture, it becomes the nucleus of an ice crystal, and that crystal attracts water molecules and gets heavier and heavier until it falls as snow or hail or melts into rain on its way down to Earth. So while Schaefer seeded that first cloud over the Berkshires, Irving Langmuir, the lead researcher on the team, watched from the airport below.
And immediately he was on the phone before the plane even landed to the New York Times with the storyline that man can control the weather. And this was the next day's headline.
For the first time in all history, there is now open to man the possibility of exerting some control over the weather. Probably the most remarkable achievement of the year.
The very same year, Bernard Vonnegut discovered a chemical that worked even better than dry ice. It was called silver iodide, and it mimicked the structure of a natural ice crystal, making it the perfect particle to attract water molecules and jumpstart precipitation. Most cloud seeding operations still use silver iodide today. Back in Fargo, WMI seeds clouds all over the world, from India to Canada to Saudi Arabia. They get lots of business, but there's also plenty of critics, and they fall into three camps. First, there's the folks who worry about the environmental repercussions. And it's true, seeding sounds pretty scary, pumping clouds full of silver iodide. But so far, studies haven't found a negative effect on the environment.
I mean, you could eat it on your Wheaties, except it tastes horrible, so I wouldn't recommend it.
You tasted it?
Well, sure, yeah. I mean, not, you know, just mixing chemical and stuff, and you get it on your hands, and you get a little mouthful of it. And yeah, it's not really a very good tasting.
Group number two is the conspiracy theorists, people who think cloud seeding is part of a worldwide government plot, like chemtrails or fluoride in the water. Allness gets a lot of angry phone calls.
They think we have some sort of godlike powers where we can just move clouds around at will and make it drought, you know, whatever fickle mood we're in that day.
A while back, he had to notify the police when someone called the office over and over again, threatening his employees by name. The third group is scientists. There's a lot of doubt among some scientists about how effective cloud seeding even is.
No cloud is the same as another cloud, and no cloud will ever be the same as another cloud.
Rulof Brientes researches cloud seeding at the National Center for Atmospheric Research. He says every cloud is a unique and chaotic swirl of variables, so it's hard to prove that a seeded cloud wouldn't have rained or snowed anyway if it had been left alone. And it's pretty much impossible to replicate results. But thanks to improved technology like satellites and computer models, Brientes says they're learning more every day.
And I think especially during the past 20 years, our understanding has increased tremendously.
The state of Wyoming recently finished a 9-year study on cloud seeding in the mountains. And the data suggests that seeded clouds snow up to 15% more than unseeded clouds. But the conditions have to be perfect, with the right wind direction, the right amount of moisture, the right temperature.
So there's no one experiment you can do in one area that will be transferable to other areas all around the world.
The bottom line is, cloud seeding seems to work in some conditions, but it's not an exact science. Well, farmers and water managers and municipalities, they don't need an exact science. They need water.
They say if it works half the time, or maybe 10% of the time, it is still worthwhile for me to execute this, because water problems globally are going to increase in the next several decades, and many people will live under severe water stresses. So we are looking at all the tools to enhance these supplies and to sustain the supplies that we have.
Brientes says cloud seeding is not the answer to water scarcity. It's more like a long-term strategy to shore up local water supplies just a little bit. Hans Allness from WMI agrees.
It's just another tool to improve our lot in life and do it in an environmentally responsible manner, I guess.
Even though we've come a long way since ESPY and Dyrenforth, we're still pretty much at the mercy of the weather.
You have to work with what nature gives you, and that's the whole name of the game, is you're just working with what nature gives you.
We can't make clouds out of thin air or orchestrate rainfall or engineer our way out of a drought. Any real lasting solution to water scarcity has to start with conservation, with major changes in the way we use water, in industry and agriculture and daily life. It's a tall order. But hey, if we can make it rain, we can do anything. Right? I'm Stephen Jackson.
That's the Allegheny Front for this week. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter. We're at Allegheny Front. Kathy Naur is the executive producer of our show. I'm Carol Holsoppel.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments, the Pittsburgh Foundation, the Foundation for Pennsylvania Watersheds, the Laurel Foundation, the Catherine Mabus McKenna Foundation, PNC Charitable Trusts, and the Benedum Foundation. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports our coverage of energy and conservation.